Usually eating a big lunch like that is not conducive to the arising of words of wisdom. Not necessarily for listening to them, but anyway, we'll give it our best shot. So I've been here at Santi Monastery for nearly 10 years now. Some of you I have known since almost the first time I've been here. Naomi, been here since Big Paddy, Kim, is around here somewhere. Where is she? Kim, there she is. Okay, very good. Paddy, where's Paddy? Very good. Okay. Anyone else? Am I missing? So, and many of others of you I've got to know over the years in between. A little bit strange that you become a monk so that you can be in seclusion and aloof from society and all of these things. And yet, you make so many friends along the way. The existence of a monastery like this is almost living proof of that a better way is possible. It's a real thing. It's not just, I think this is one of the most important things that a monastery can offer. We get very cynical about humanity and about what people are and what they do and so on. I read in the paper this morning that the new study shows that the super rich in the world have spirited away $13 trillion, is the latest estimate. $13 trillion. That's been shifted out into tax havens and the like by the super rich. That's a lot of money. $13 trillion. And in the face of such overwhelming greed, the existence of a place like this, very humble, in a way it's nothing special, it's just a few buildings on a piece of bush, but it is also very, very special. And of course any acknowledgement, I mean, I can't even hope to acknowledge all of the people who've given and offered during the period, but we can't go without mentioning, of course, the greatest donor of them all is Elizabeth Gorski, who gave us the land and the basis of the buildings that we're living on. And now our sister Neroda, Vikoni Neroda, she'd probably be mortified. She's very humble. She supported this place, and not just this place, but many other places as well. So Nyatarang Monastery also donated by her, and also many other places around the Sydney region were supported by her while she was around. So that's how much difference one person can make. When I came here, nearly 10 years ago, I came in about, I think it was March or April 2003, there was very little happening here. There was one monk at the time, one caretaker, and then Danny, and the other monk was here, I think Kemananda left before that rains, and so there was talk of closing the place down in that range of food in 2003. It was felt that there wasn't anybody to bring dharma. Nobody was bringing dharma at all at that time. There was no support. And the proposal was that the place be shut down and closed up for that period. Well, so I just said, well, I'm going to stay here anyway. And if there's not anybody here, well, I'll go hungry. But I'll just stay here and I'll have faith that things will come together. That's all. I had no idea how they would come together. I had no idea how we'd do anything. But I was just saying, okay, we'll just stay. I'll just stay. And of course, things worked out okay. We had one layman, Valvik, came for that rains retreat. And he did the cooking and so on for that rains. And so we had a nice time together. And that was the beginning of what we've done here. So I look back over the years, and many remarkable things that we've done. As you can see, probably the most remarkable, most important thing is to build a community that you're all part of. To give people a chance to experience the way of practice of the forest tradition, to support the monastics who come to live here, and especially to those who have decided to ordain here. In the room now we have Bhattacharya, Vimalananda, Sada, who have all taken ordination here, and since I can't remember which year we started, probably the first ordination we did was maybe 2005 or 2006. course, the one of the main things that we've done, as well as all those things, is to support the Bhikkhuni community. And this has been something that's been of great personal importance to me. When I was at Bodhinyana in WA in about 1998, it would have been, I remember having a conversation with my sister. And my sister is a very good person, unlike me. She is very together, organized. But basically, if you look at all of those things that I'm not, then she is those things. And she's not a particularly either pro or anti-spiritual person. Yeah? She's more she's very interested in social justice issues and things like that. And she said one time when we were talking, she said very kind of gently and not in a negative or critical way at all, but she just said that she'd found that she couldn't really, she found it difficult to commit or become really invested in any religion because none of them gave women a fair go. And that kind of really struck me when she said that. And you know, I began to wonder what kind of religion is this if my sister can't get a fair go, because she's actually an okay person. So maybe the rest, or every other woman in the world, might not be. Maybe every other woman in the world is completely messed up, but my sister is okay. I know that. I can't vouch for everybody else. And there's something wrong there. And I knew that there was something wrong, but I didn't know what could be done about it. At that time, of course, in Bodhinyana, we were supporting the establishment of Dhammasara Nuns Monastery. And that actually happened during the period I was there. And I don't claim any credit for it. That was done by the Buddhist Society together with Ajahn Brahm. But that was in that period, and so we were becoming aware of some of these issues, and that was the time we invited Ajahn Wayama to go over there and found the Nuns Monastery. So subsequent to that, I spent some time in Malaysia, some time in Thailand, and actually my time, especially my time in Malaysia, was also very formative for me, because I got to get to know quite a lot of monks from outside of my own tradition. I was ordained in the Ajahn Chah tradition, and up to then I'd only really known monks from within that tradition. So I got to meet monks from outside that tradition, and I got to meet nuns, and I got to meet people from, I got to know much better people from Mahayana backgrounds and other Buddhist traditions. And as I did that, I began to see and to understand better the common or the shared or the core elements between all of these things, the things that united the Buddhists from different backgrounds and different traditions. And I could see that even though, yes, of course, I mean, people who know me, I'm a scholar. I have a very strong critical mind. I do text critical studies and I analyze all the differences between texts and all of these kinds of things. So I'm not somebody who sweeps differences under the carpet and tries to ignore them. But at the same time, I'm also aware that if you look at those things that really matter, then there is so much that's held in common among all these different traditions. And the other thing that I noticed my time when I spent more than a year in Ipoh, at the Sukhavana cave in Ipoh, and if there's anybody from Ipoh who's here, oh, we've heard at least one Ipoh person here. Yeah? Anyone else from Ipoh? Shout out to all the Ipoh people here. Okay, so anyone Ipohist? My time in Ipoh, one of the other things that was very obvious was that almost most of the people who came to the monastery were women, and that included basically all of the meditators. The blokes used to come and like to hang around and chat and do work and stuff like that and argue about Dhamma. But when it came to meditation time, the really serious practitioners were all women, and some of them very serious. And one of the families who used to support me every day bringing Dhamma, one of the sisters in that family is now Sister Hasapanya, also in Dhammasara Monastery. And so I knew her very well from Ipoh, and that was the time that she decided she wanted to become a nun. And I remember the day that she came and told me that she wanted to become a nun. A couple of days earlier we'd been talking, and I referred to, and I think probably read, the suttas that King Ashoka had recommended for the Sangha to study. So in Buddhist history, the earliest concrete record of the names of Buddhist scriptures are found in some of the pillars of King Ashoka. It's about 250 BC. And one of the texts which King Ashoka mentions as his like curriculum for recommended study for the Sangha is the suttas on the, they call the Anagatabhayani Sutra, it's the suttas on the fears of the future. And essentially these suttas, basically what they say is, we don't know what's going to happen in the future, so we better do it now. So when she heard that, she felt very stirred and felt that she wanted to practice as a nun, and then embarked on that course. Eventually she's now one of the co-abbots at Dhammasara Monk Monastery. So as I began to look into these two things, really, one thing was what is the shared basis of the Buddhist tradition, those things that's really valuable about the Buddhist tradition, and also at that, obviously what was a very pressing need to find a valid and supportive and authentic way for women to practice within Buddhism, especially within the forest tradition. And kind of the outcome of those two considerations, obviously, was what led to my support for the bhikkhuni ordination. Earlier, myself, like Ajahn Brahm and others, had been convinced by this idea that, you know, it's better to just have 10 precept nuns and it won't cause so much trouble and so on. And anyway, I gave up that heresy and eventually managed to make Ajahn Brahm see the light as well. I wouldn't claim to ever have the capacity to make Ajahn Brahm change his mind about anything, but certainly a lot of the work and advocacy and so on that I was doing was influential there. So to me, this has been a very fascinating journey on many levels, and it's become clear to me. And again, this is something that first occurred to me when I was in Ipoh, and I remember this thinking that, well, look, if you're going to take this seriously about supporting the nuns and so on, that there's going to have to be something concrete to it. It's not just an idea. You're going to have to do something about it. Actually, even in those days, and this was like 2000. I was planning, as I was going to leave that place, because my visa was running out, I was planning, wanted to recommend to the committee that they see if they could find some nuns to run the place and have it as a nuns monastery, because it would have been an ideal place for a nuns monastery. Unfortunately, there were some problems in the committee at the time, which were later sorted out, but at that time there were some problems, and that wasn't able to happen. So this is really, really important, that there has to be an actual basis to this. If we want to support within Buddhism, if we want to support women's spirituality, the ability for women to practice and develop without feeling that they're being discriminated against and all of those things, then that has to be done within the frameworks which is offered within the Buddhist tradition. Right, that's what the Buddhist tradition is. we can't just invent something out of whole cloth. We have to look what is our tradition and how do we live that, practice that authentically. And when we look at our tradition, then we see, of course, the Buddha established the Bhikkhuni Sangha. We don't have a lack of a prototype or a role model. It's there. It's fully laid out and described for us. So then our problem, our task has to be, our challenge has to be to find a way to bring that and make it real. And that's what a monastery is. A monastery is a place where these things are not just ideas anymore. In our modern times, monasteries have become much more complicated entities. In the old days, you walk through the forest and sort of set up a mosquito net and stay there, and that's kind of okay, but you can't really do that anymore. We've got like property titles and insurance and OHS and all of those contractors and all of those things, which have to be dealt with and so on. And so to do that at Santi, we have a committee who's been doing a wonderful job over the last 10 years, helping to support the Sangha by making all of those, putting all those legal frameworks together. And a little bit later on, and then inviting Paddy to, as a representative of the committee, to say a few words. So it's important to remember that all of these things have to be there. A place like this just doesn't exist out of nowhere. It exists because of the work of so many people. So people who know me will know that I'm not the sort of person who has kind of grand sort of plans or anything like that. I don't even have little plans. I take things as much as I can on a kind of day-to-day basis, which I realise can be a source of great annoyance for people around me who have to try to do petty things like organise things, which I'm not very good at. So, you know, I've always had a word vision is a very debased word these days, but I guess that's how I operate. I'm always on a level of vision of saying, well, where do we want to go and what do we want to achieve? And without having necessarily too much of a fixed idea of what the road is to get there. So as in for myself, and what I've always tried to do is I try to, on the one hand, to live here as best as I can, to live here, practice my meditation, and do my own study and practice as best I can. And Santi Monastery is really one of the best places in the world for that. For those of you who've travelled around the Buddhist world and seen there are a lot of places to practice, but often it's difficult with things like food and so on. Santi is extremely quiet, extremely beautiful. There's a very strong energy here. It's a little bit cold in the winter time. But that's about the only kind of major drawback here. In many ways, we're very privileged, we're very lucky in terms of being able, infrastructure. We get water from the town water supply. Yeah, that's a huge deal. I was just at Jhana Grove in WA, and you know the amount of money that they spent on their water supply there is unbelievable. Yeah? Pumps and filters and tanks and it costs huge amounts of money. We just turn on the tap. Okay. So in many ways, Santi has been a very easy, physically a very easy place to live. And we've also been very lucky because the community from Sydney, and most people here from Sydney, anyone from Canberra here today? A few people from Canberra, okay, of course. A few from Canberra. We also had very good supporters from Canberra as well. But the bulk of our supporters have been from Sydney. Also Wollongong. Where's John? Here. Okay, yeah. Wollongong. Excellent. the community has been very wonderfully supportive, and many people have come for many reasons, and I think everybody who comes gets something out of it. I think for many of us, obviously it's nice to go to a quiet and peaceful place, but hey, there's plenty of quiet and peaceful places that you can go to. There's something more to it, and I think there's something to this idea. You know, when you see the kutis, the caves, see the kind of lifestyle that we live here, there's something about the simplicity, the authenticity of what we're doing here, which I think is very touching, very moving. And one thing which has been quite noteworthy is that we've always had a lot of support from people from many different Buddhist traditions, and not just the tradition that myself is trained in Thailand. We have people from the Thai community, Rena and others, but also from, obviously, many from the Sri Lankan community and Burmese and so on. We've also had a lot of support from the Vietnamese community, obviously, the Western community and others, and also the different Buddhist traditions. Venerable Yeshe is here visiting us again, one of our long-term friends. And we've had many supporters and friends here from different monastic traditions as well. And this is also something that I'm very proud of, something that I've seen in many forms of Buddhism, and I think it's very unfortunate that people become very insular, that they only associate with people from their own tradition. And so for me, it's been very important to accept and to welcome people from all different traditions and backgrounds. Within this, that kind of diversity and the different things that we've done, the essence, or for me, the core of what's important for me, has always been the two basic things that I keep coming back to. One is the experience of the Dhamma in meditation, and the second thing is the study and the understanding of the suttas and the early Buddhist teachings. And so These two things have been the basis for my Buddhist life right from the beginning. The very first thing that I did, I did read one book. I read a book by Ajahn Buddhadasa before I did a retreat. I didn't really understand much of it. Then I did a retreat, and so that was it. After that retreat, I was a Buddhist. I knew that, and I knew I just wanted to practice somehow. I didn't know how or what I was going to do, but I knew that's what I wanted to do. So meditation was always the beginning. And then after we came out of the retreat, it was a month-long retreat, and I asked people, you know, what, do you have any books I can read? And they gave me one or two books, and I thought, oh yeah, that's all right. Kind of boring, really. I won't tell you what books they were. I thought, oh, that's kind of all right. But it was a bit kind of new agey, kind of wishy-washy stuff. I don't know, people seem to like that stuff, but anyway, I thought it was a bit, I didn't like it very much. And I said, well, where's the real stuff? And then they said, oh, well, the Majjhima Nikaya is over there. So I picked up the Majjhima Nikaya. Ah, that was it, I was gone. And as soon as I started reading the Majjhima Nikaya, ah, this is what the Buddha taught. Yeah? It's not just someone's opinion, this is what the Buddha taught. And it's very hard to explain these things. To me, there's something about the suttas which has this kind of ring of authenticity to it. I can't explain it objectively. And in some ways, it's because it chimed with my own experience in meditation. Those two things always seem to go together. I never had any problems with it. And when I listen to other teachers, I always, you know, oh, something is good and some things maybe have some questions or problems with. But when I read the suttas, it's again and again and again, the splendor and the magnificence of the way that the Buddha presents the Dhamma, even from the smallest things through to the most profound teachings. And so these teachings of the Buddha in the early suttas and also my own meditation practice, these have been the two guiding principles for my own spiritual development in these last nearly 20 years, and that's been the main focus of everything that I've done here at Sankey. meditate and to study and understand the Buddha's teachings a little bit better. And I hope that that will continue to be a guiding principle for the community after I've left. For myself, most of you have probably read the announcement that I put on the internet, and I'm leaving purely for my own personal reasons. My leaving doesn't really have anything to do with Santi as such. To the extent that it does, which is only really a secondary thing, really, I do feel that it's time for if we want to establish a bhikkhuni community here very strongly, then that has to be done with the bhikkhunis leading the way, and it can't be done with me leading the way. So I've done what I can. But regardless of that, the main reason why I want to leave is not really because of that, or it's not really because of Santi at all. It's just because I feel that it's something that I need to do. I'm not very good at articulating it, and I think that when we make these big decisions, often we don't really understand them at the time, and it's only much later that we'll actually understand what it means. And certainly, you know, if I look back in my life at the time when I left Sydney and went to Thailand to ordain, you know, at the time I didn't really have any idea what I was doing or why I was doing it. It's only when I reflect back now that I can understand it. Similarly, when I say left Thailand and came to Australia, I had very vague notions of what I wanted and why I was doing that. But it's only now as I look back I can see more clearly what that was and why I was doing that. So even though I can't articulate it in a way that's very clear or very satisfactory, I don't have any doubt myself that it's the right thing to do. If I was to try to articulate it more clearly, and I was discussing this a little bit earlier with somebody, when I came here from Thailand, it was because there was a shift. For the first 10 years when I was practicing Dhamma, I was very content just to be practicing, to be studying and meditating, and that was exactly what was right for me. But gradually, at the end of that period, I had this kind of shift where I also wanted to be speaking, whether speaking literally or metaphorically. But I felt that there were things that I was doing or understanding or something which actually could be valuable and could be helpful. And specifically, I wanted to contribute and have a role where I could contribute within this culture, within an Australian culture. I didn't really know how that would happen, but I thought that there was something that I could bring that would be of use. And I felt not just that it would be of use for others, but also that in some way that it was answering to my own need, my own spiritual development, that I needed to take that role on. I'm not sure what that sounds like to you, but that's just sort of trying to somehow articulate how I felt when I came from Thailand to Australia. And so in a similar sense now, I feel almost like that I've said all those things that I wanted to say. You know, if you look in the suttas, one of the things about the suttas is the Buddha kept on repeating himself all the time. I really hate repeating myself. And anyway, I'm sure I'll do it, but anyway, maybe the Buddha wouldn't have to repeat himself so many times if he'd had done it to record everything and put it on the web. So I don't know how long that feeling will last or anything like that, but that's just how I feel at the moment. And so my aim is to go and spend some time in seclusion, spend some time with my father, and after that, I really don't have any plans. And as I've said to many people, I don't have plans to go away. I actually like being in Sydney, and I like, you know, the community here and what we're doing and so on and so forth. So there's every likelihood that I'll be back in the region before too long. However, I'm not making any plans. Well, one one plan only, and that is the plan to have no plans. And that's, I think that's, to me that's quite exciting, and I quite look forward to that idea of having that freedom of having just nothing. No expectations, no hopes, no fears. And just to see where that takes me. And over the last few months I've been annoying people by telling them stories of things that have happened to me in my life where I've done that, and it kind of works out. One example of those stories, and I'll just bore all those people who've heard it already, I'm boring them by telling it again, but it's a very simple story. But a few weeks ago now, we were videoing the talks on Friday night, and video specialist Alex was adjusting the stand and broke it. We needed a new stand. So we looked up on the web, where do we buy one from, how do we get there, where do we park, where do we get money, blah, 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 how much does it cost, blah, blah, blah. And meanwhile, we went for lunch with our Pali class, and we were in Newtown. We're walking back through the streets of Newtown. If you know, in the back streets of Newtown, it's very kind of, there are these kind of very small, old sort of workers' cottages and things in those back streets, and we're sort of walking through one of those back laneways. Just purely at random, because we thought, well, we just walked down a street we've never been down before just to see what's there. So we just walked down there, and sitting on the front porch of one of these little terrace houses was a guy who was having a garage sale, and he had like, you know, a dozen things from his house he was selling, a bicycle and a chair and this and that, and one of them was a video camera stand, which is exactly what we wanted, and it was like really cheap and it was really good. And not only that, but he showed us how to adjust it so that we wouldn't break it like we broke a previous saw. So I'm like, well, that proves that we should all live the rest of our lives like that. Never plan anything. If you want to buy something, just wander down the road at random and there it will be. Anyway, that's I'm going to try to test that hypothesis. see whether it works out. So even though we can kind of laugh about it, but there is actually something to that, and this is actually one of the very first lessons in Eastern spirituality which I ever learned, long before I encountered Buddhism. My first encounter with the profundities of Eastern philosophy was with the Tao of Pu. Has anyone read the Tao of Pu? We have a copy downstairs if you haven't got it. Yeah. Isn't it? Yeah. So that's where I learned about many, many profound things that have informed my life. And one of the things that I learned about there was that Winnie the Pooh was always happy because he never worried about things too much. Yeah? And he was a bear of very little brain, which means that he didn't overthink things. He just let them happen. And then somehow, because he let them sort of happen, they sort of worked out okay in the end, but he wasn't interfering with them too much. And so it's something that I've kind of observed over the years, and actually it is very true, and very often that we don't, yeah, I mean, obviously in some cases we have to plan and all of those things. Make a seat or bring a seat up for a little bit. I do think that it's useful from time to time to sort of wipe the slate clean and then see what will come back. Actually, since I've announced my intention to retire, I've spoken to a lot of people who've come up to me to talk about their midlife crises. It's very surprising how this happens. Or even late life crises, you know, people who come up and, you know, their children have grown up and they've left home, and what do they do now? Yeah, they've been looking forward to having such a peaceful time for so many years, but now they're just sitting alone in their home, like lonely, and they're sad and depressed and they don't know what to do. Right? So there's a lot of people who feel, I mean, these are stages of life that we go through. And so I do think that it's useful from time to time to just have that courage to just let things go and then see what comes back. It's not a matter of getting rid of everything or not wanting to do anything or any of those kinds of things. It's just a matter of putting things to one side and then seeing what's of real value. Okay? Because we tend to, you know, it's like moving home. Yeah? If you stay in one home for too long, you sort of tend to accumulate all this junk. And then when you move home, it's a good opportunity to leave all the rubbish behind and just take the things that really matter. So that's a process that I'll be going through in the next few days. So my good friend Charles Barton just moved house, and you know, all these boxes and stuff and all of these things, and I'm thinking to myself, well, I've got to move home from here, and I've been here for 10 years. I have to make sure to leave at least a couple of hours to do my packing. Not that I'll take that long to pack, but to take that long for you to get rid of the things that I'm not going to pack will take a couple of hours. Then since I mentioned a couple of months ago and let people know that this is what I was planning to do, I've been very heartened and very, it's been very beautiful and very, I felt very supported, very loved by the community, and I felt that there's been a great deal of understanding of what I've been doing. Not necessarily understanding in the sense of, you know, knowing exactly why I'm doing it, because I certainly don't understand it in that sense, but understanding in the sense that, well, people respect the decision that I'm doing. And I've also been very heartened and encouraged by the response of the Sangha, the Bhikkhunis, especially Asudama and Padachara, who've been here through the whole time and planning to take the reins, and now joined by Ayadamananda. Also, Aya Prasada and Aya Manisara have been helping us through the process. And and the committee, of course, and all the people who've been helping to organise things. It's very, it's essential for the maturing of the Bhikkhuni community and the Buddhist community in their relation to the Bhikkhuni community, that the Bhikkhunis be able to live, to learn, to thrive and manage and run the community and for themselves. This is how it was in the early days of the Buddha, and that's how it should be today. And I think it's, you know, I understand fully that it's not an easy thing to do. There's a lot of new skills that need to be learned and a lot of challenges and so on. Those things are all good. We shouldn't be afraid of the hard work or the responsibility or the challenges. And I'm not someone who's ever let my choices be determined by fear. Yeah? And a lot of times people say, well, that would be a lot of hard work, or that would be a hard thing to do or something. I've never let that stop me. If something's hard to do, you just do it anyway. And you learn how to do hard things. So what? It's life, you do some hard things in life, big deal. So the fact that it's hard shouldn't be an issue. The only issue is it something that's really worthwhile? Is it something that we really want to do? And if it's something that you really want to do, it doesn't matter how hard it is. You just do it anyway. And so for the Bhikkhunis in this period coming up, and they've been very wonderful in stepping up and contributing and working together and trying to help establish a place here. And when I say Bhikkhunis, of course I mean all the number, not meaning to exclude Padachara, who's still some an area. for all the nuns who've been here and are looking after the place. So I want to ask you as a Buddhist community to continue with that, and to give your support for the nuns, to, you know, and to recognize, each person to recognize for yourselves. This is crucial for the development of Buddhism. Make no mistake, the days of patriarchal religions are over. Full stop. There are desperate, embattled, fundamentalist patriarchies all around the world, from the Vatican to the Islam to the Anglican Church to the Buddhist, various Buddhist churches and Hinduism and so on, and they're all fighting these very sad rearguard actions to try to hold on to their discriminations and privileges and power and all of those silly things. And those rearguard actions are doomed to fail for one simple reason, and that simple reason is because they are completely against all of the principles of love and compassion and understanding which all of these religions are based on. And so they are doomed to fail. So make no mistake, that will happen, and we have the opportunity to build something beautiful. Our choice is not between do we have a sangha of bhikkhus only and do we have a sangha with bhikkhus and bhikkhunis only. Our choice is do we have a sangha or not. If we don't develop a bhikkhuni community, then the only form of Buddhism which will survive in the future will be a secularized, basically new age lay Buddhism. And hey, maybe that's what should survive. I don't know. But if we believe in the Sangha, and if we believe that there is a place in the world for those who really want to practice in the way that the Buddha laid down in every respect, starting from the sila, the ethics, the practice, everything, then we need to support the establishment and the thriving of the bhikkhuni community. So this will take time, and we can't expect too much. We can't expect quick results. You know, we're not looking at 10 years down the road. We're looking at 30 or 50 or 100 years down the road for a really well-established and thriving bhikkhuni community. It takes that kind of that depth of teaching and, you know, all of those things, the grounding and that breadth in the practice. So for the moment, the bhikkhuni community, we're in a constant dialogue about these things. How do we interpret certain vinaya rules? How do we do certain kinds of things? And you know, we've been in discussions with the bhikkhunis here constantly for years about these things, and none of them are fully resolved. They are things which the bhikkhuni communities will gradually work out and evolve over the next several decades. Even though Santi itself is a small, you know, small-sized community. You can see we have had a very large impact. We have at the moment 6 bhikkhunis and 1 seminary here today. So the ones who are living here, and Asadira and Ayesha, who are visiting. This is very rare in the world to have 6 bhikkhunis in one room, isn't it? And so I made the invitation on Friday night when we had 5, now we've got 6. So if anybody wants to have a quick ordination, now's your chance. So this is really something special, something which needs to be protected and nurtured with understanding and with compassion. As we've done our little bit here at Santi to support this, of course there are many other people all around the world who are doing this, and often on a much kind of larger scale. Obviously the biggest movement towards establishing the bhikkhunis within Theravada has been in Sri Lanka, where we now have certainly hundreds, perhaps 1,000 bhikkhunis now in Sri Lanka. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Asadira's come back from there fairly recently. About 1,000 maybe. So that's quite amazing, isn't it? Yeah. And even in Thailand now, it's hard to get figures, but maybe 50 or 100 bhikkhunis in Thailand. I would think, maybe.
Theravada
bhikkhunis, yeah. Sun helping to establish the Gautami Vihara in KL, and so on and so forth. So these things are happening everywhere around the world. So one of the good things is that the community here has a lot of very strong connections with those bhikkhuni communities, and I've encouraged them on behalf of the Sangha, but also it's something to think about on behalf of the lay community, is also to get in touch with and be a part of the community of bhikkhunis internationally. Especially, we have especially close connections with the bhikkhunis, obviously in Dhammasara in Perth, and also with Aranya Bodhi in the US and other places as well, but they're probably the two main ones. And so to take an interest in these things, get to know the people, listen to the teachings, introduce yourselves on Facebook to people, get to know those communities and bring people in so that we're part of that network. If the community here is kind of isolated and just a few people, then it can feel sometimes like it's too hard. But if it's part of a much bigger network, then that's, I think, the only way that it can really be possible. So that's something that something to think about for everyone here, and I know that some of the bhikkhunis are contactable through Facebook and so on and so forth. So it would be terrific to get in touch with them, just introduce yourselves, and